Have you heard of Petri wines? I hadn't until a couple of days ago because I'm not a big wine drinker. I enjoy it, but I don't study it. But I was out walking my usual 5.5 miles and listening to an old Sherlock Holmes radio show from 1945. Petri Wines was the sponsor, and I was curious if it was still around. So I found this blog from Media Heritage. Quote, "Listeners who tune in to Theater of the Mind for the adventures of Sherlock Holmes often hear Harry Bartell and Nigel Bruce discuss Petri wines before a new case is introduced. Petri, the family that took time to bring you good wine, brought the adventures of Sherlock Holmes into living rooms from 1939 to 1946. When Basil Rathbone left the show, Petri wine did as well. Tom Conway stepped in to play Sherlock Holmes, and Cremel Hair Tonic became the new sponsor. Have you ever wondered what happened to Petri wines? Luckily, this mystery can be solved without the talents of Sherlock Holmes and his dear friend Watson. In the spirit of Harry Bartell, this is a longer post than normal. I suggest that you pour yourself a nice glass of sherry or port before continuing. Petri wine takes its name from the founder of the winery, Raphael Petri. He opened the Petri Wine Company in the San Joaquin Valley in 1886. Petri expanded operations by purchasing another vineyard in Escalon, north of Modesto, and close to the main winery in 1916. In 1935, Louis A. Petri, the grandson of Raphael, left school where he was studying medicine to work with his family. In 1939, Petri Wines became a sponsor of The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes and had a robust lineup of wines ranging from red, white, rosé, sparkling, aperitif, and dessert wines. 2 years before Petri canceled sponsorship of the program, Louis Petri became president of the company, and that's when Petri Wines started on its way to becoming one of the biggest wineries in the United States. After purchasing the Tulare Wine Company and Mission Bell Winery, Petri became the third largest winery in California. Louis Petri continued to grow the company by forming Allied Grape Growers and creating another company called United Vintners, which Petri Wines became a part of. United Vintners then sold their wineries to the Allied Grape Growers. Many more major deals were in the works, and by the early 1950s, United Vintners were producing more wine than Roma Wine, a longtime sponsor of the show Suspense. For the next 14 years that Louis Petri was president, acquisitions were made and publicity as well. A World War II tanker was turned into a vessel for carrying wine, so California wines could be delivered to Texas and New York, bypassing the railways. In 1968, United Vintners sold to Hublin, which at one point owned Kentucky Fried Chicken and Smirnoff Vodka. In 1982, R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company bought Hublin, and when R.J. Reynolds merged with Nabisco, pieces of Hublin were sold off. In 2003, Bronco Wine Company purchased the Escalon site where Petri first expanded in 1916. The Bronco Wine Company owns more than 60 brands of wine, like Charles Schaw, $2 Buckchuck to Trader Joe's shoppers, and Crane Lake. So, if you're feeling like a glass of Petri wine, you may have already drank something close to it without knowing it." End quote. So, there's some wine trivia for you. I've seen a parrot rescue vehicle on the freeway a few times and thought, does Sacramento have a parrot problem? My ex-in-laws had a parrot. Their daughter couldn't take it with her when she moved, so her parents inherited it. It definitely had a personality. Its cage was in the kitchen, and at Christmas, as we were opening presents in the living room, she could hear the rustling paper and would call out, "What is it?" Steve Hildreth and Dana Strom of Parrot Planet not only rescue birds and rehome them, but also breed parrots and match them to the best owners. When you enter the store, the first thing you'll notice is that most of the birds are not in cages, but hanging out on perches. If you stand near or walk by and they like you, you may find yourself as a temporary perch as one lands on your shoulder, which happened to me with a bird named Buttons. My interview with them was held in the back room as the quietest place in the store, but as you'll hear, we still had some loud company. It piqued my curiosity when I kept seeing this parrot rescue vehicle on the freeway because I didn't know it was a problem. And then I started thinking about birds in general, and I didn't even have a bird when I was a kid. It wasn't even a point of interest. I didn't have any friends that had birds, and I'd never realized it on a conscious level before. So the first time I had one was my ex-husband worked at a bar, and a customer came in with a cockatiel. They were moving and they couldn't keep it, and so Mark said, oh, we'll take it. Like, okay. Mm-hmm. And it was this nervous bird, just kept walking back and forth, just, you know, constantly, nonstop, and so he named it after his mother. And then a few months later, he brings home a minor bird.
Oh.
Same situation. So the minor bird was interesting to me only as we were learning about birds as we went along, because neither one of us had any experience. And someone told us that you shouldn't get a tall cage for a minor bird because they have a tendency to, as they're flying in, it'll decorate your walls. And so, like, oh, good to know. Thanks for telling us. Mm-hmm. So you probably encountered so many different bird situations, scenarios, that you could write a book or have your own podcast.
Well, it's definitely been a consideration of ours, I can tell you that. You know, I mean, I think birds are the number three, you know, pet in the United States. You know, a lot of people don't talk about them because it's not like people are walking their bird out on the street like they do their dog, or, you know, taking their, you know, bird, you know, dog and cat vets tend to be, you know, real prominent because there's just so many of them. But believe it or not, there are a lot of bird people out there too. And I think that one of the, you know, as you mentioned earlier about the growing number of parrot rescues, I just think that a lot of people, you know, go out and buy birds without really considering what they're getting in the type of living situation that they're in. And that's one of the things that, you know, I know myself and Dana has really made it a point to make sure that, you know, when people are getting birds, whether they're purchasing one or through the store, or they're, you know, going to get a rescue bird from us, you know, they understand what they're getting and what they're getting themselves into, you know, both by how long they live and, you know, the size of the cage they're going to need and, you know, what kind of noise they're going to be making.
Especially the latter,
yes. That's the big part of it. And I think, you know, for us, because, you know, we, especially Dana, have been doing the rescue for, you know, over 15 years, and, you know, the number one, you know, birds that, you know, tend to see hit those rescues are, you know, Moluccan cockatoos and umbrella cockatoos that we've made the point, you know, even in our own breeding facility and through our store, that we refuse to carry those kind of birds because they wind up in bad situations because the noise gets to be too much. And I think it's you know, responsible breeding on our side by not continuing to propagate the problem.
Well, we also learned that they're very sensitive to temperature. We were told very specifically to make sure that it wasn't near a draft, that a simple cold could just, you know, have a devastating effect. Is that true?
A lot of that's urban legend. I mean,
oh, is it? Okay.
Okay, I mean, the bird's out in the tree, and he's not.
Well, that's what I thought, but, you know, I had no experience, so I went, okay.
Yeah, if you can handle it, they can handle it, whether it be, you know, heat or cold. I mean, same thing with covering. Do I need to cover my bird at night? No, you don't need to cover your bird at night. That's, you know, some people's birds get a little vocal, and covering them might, you know, help as far as, you know, keeping that noise level down. But no, it's not. You don't have to do that.
Okay. See? Mythbusters.
Yes.
Mythbusters. Now, we're listening to a few birds in the back room here. Tell me about what you've got, your residence back here.
Well, we kind of covered the gamut of parrotness. So we do boarding. So what you're hearing right now are birds that are boarding with us, and they have their little vocabularies, their little sounds. That was a macaw. And then we also get birds for rehoming, birds that cannot be kept for a variety of reasons, usually sad reasons. and then we keep the birds back here, and I try and work with them to see what their issues are. We have two right now. One bird was given up to us. That bird will never be a pet. It does not want to be a pet. It wants to be a breeder. Mm. I have another one that was just given up that clearly wants to be a pet, and it flies to everyone that comes within range.
Social.
So, very social, very social. So one thing that Stephen and I have always tried to do is let parrots have a say in their life, because they live a long time. They're very intelligent. Some people probably shouldn't own a parrot because of their distinctive pluses and minuses as pets. But if you get what it's like to own a parrot, it's nothing like owning a dog or a cat. It's a whole different experience, and it's intense. And if you get it, we joke about it. We call it being infected with the birdie virus. If you're infected, you're done for. There's no cure, and you're just going to be a total bird lover for the rest of your life.
Well, what are some of the pluses and minuses of owning a parrot?
One of the pluses are parrots are extremely physically affectionate, which not a lot of people think. You think of bunnies and kitties being affectionate. Parrots want to sit on you. They want to groom you. They want to eat what you're eating. They want to watch TV with you. They're like your soulmate. They want to be with you. I mean, intensely, like a dog. They want to be with you every second of the day. They'd like to go in the shower with you. They like to sleep in the bed with you. So it's a very strong bond. And if they don't get that bond, depending on the type of parrot, they will then start screaming. And that's one of the minuses. Because then you have to balance the bird with its natural desire to be in love with you and be with you, and the fact that we all have jobs that we have to go to. And what does your birdie do when they're alone? And I mean, there's been books and books and books of books written about birds, their behaviors. They suffer separation anxiety, jealousy, grief, joy. They really do. They really do. They're very sentient beings. And they're not like, nothing against goldfish, but they're not like a little fishy in the bowl, you know. They have definite
you
needs.
Have to interact with them.
Absolutely have to.
Unlike the goldfish.
Yeah, and they will grieve. And in the bad ones that I've seen throughout the years of rescue, is not only will they grieve, but they will self-mutilate, sometimes to the point of death. And that's the sad part of owning parrots, that people either aren't aware of or don't care. I don't know. We see things, people bring their birds in the store that, to me, I'm horrified by the condition of the birds, and it doesn't seem to have affected the owner any.
Hey, tell me about molting. I have a vague memory of molting, but I can't remember what I was told.
Molting is just a normal process of the regrowth of feathers, especially when they're babies. They grow out feathers each year, you know. It's kind of like you and I just regrowing our hair on a cyclical basis.
Or a snake's skin.
Yeah. There are clues to the way a bird will molt that can tell you something about his health issues.
I think that's it. I think someone was trying to give me a clue in what to look for, but it was so many years ago, I don't recall what they were.
It's pretty obvious if you see a ratty-looking bird, tattered and without sleek feathers, I'd say that bird's got an issue.
Well, yeah, because it bothered me. I didn't know if it was just naturally molting or if there was an issue. I had no reference point on how to determine which category it fell in. So I didn't like that responsibility of an animal's life. Cat or dog? Fairly straightforward. But birds are, like you say, a completely, completely different species. Just, now, you were talking about when they're alone and you're off at work or bicycle riding or what have you. Are there specific toys? I understand you sell toys here. Are there some that are better than others for listeners to look for?
Well, I think one of the important things is, and if when it comes to selecting toys, first of all, toys are a very vital part of, you know, the bird's behavior. If you ever watch a bird in the wild, they're tearing leaves and branches off the trees and sitting there and, you know, tearing that stuff apart. It's really good for their mental well-being. But my philosophy when it comes to toys with birds is that if they can't destroy it, it's not a good toy. So I tend to, you know, keep toys inside the store that are, you know, are really good for their, you know, not only tearing up, making, you know, so it's good mentally, but there's also some challenging toys we call foraging toys that that kind of, you know, that challenge their, you know, their thinking. And
for example,
there's things where there's little drawers that they can open and get little treats out of it, or foraging toys where there's like little pieces of bark or cuttle bone inside of it that they can pull out and chew and tear apart, or blocks inside of there. You got to give them things to do, and just sticking a bird in a cage, you know, 24/7, and you know, putting it in the corner, that's not a healthy situation for them.
It's mean.
And, you know, unfortunately, the birds don't get a choice, you know, like you and I do, where they want to live, or, you know, how their house is going to be decorated. So I think as a responsible owner, you really need to make sure the bird has a sufficient size cage and a lot of things to do. And even as much as, you know, leaving a television or a radio on for them, you know, keep them company while you're gone.
Now, is it true what I was told about the height of the cage for the bird? And
well, that's more the species. You know, things like minor birds or toucans tend to eat more, you know, fruit diet and pellet diet, so their droppings are real runny. So the size of the cage really ain't going to make any difference as far as where the droppings wind up. You
well, know, the point was they would relieve themselves mid-flight as they're flying up and down, and that's how it...
Most birds, just like people, don't poop when they're moving.
See? Another mist. Busted. Now, it's interesting to me that you have your birds not in cages in your facility here. So them flying away has never been an issue? Is that because you raised them, or maybe they were pets before and were trained, or all the above? Or?
Well, kind of a little bit. We clip all the birds' wings.
Okay.
We believe in keeping the birds out of cages. You know, they're happier.
Well,
even
yeah.
our own birds at home, when we're home, they're out of cages, and they're out, you know, free to play on stands or on top of their cages if they want. You know, birds are roaming creatures. You know, they wanna you know, be where you are. They're very social. They wanna be a part of the family. So again, you know, locking up in a cage is just not the smart thing to do on a all day 24/7 basis. So we find that by keeping them out, you know, they're much more social. You know, the people can interact with them and really get a better feel for what their personality is like.
Another thing we try and do is offer people, because a lot of people own birds and they're well-meaning, but they didn't do their research as to what birds need. And we'll have people come in and say, oh, yeah, I have a bird, but I haven't let him out of his cage in 8 years. Well, that's not uncommon. And we try, you know, gently and non-judgmentally to let people understand that's not okay to do to really any animal, but particularly an animal as intelligent as a parrot.
And there's a reason they have wings.
And there's a reason that they are foraging animals, and they talk, and they use language appropriately. They're not just mimicking sounds. They know what they're saying. I mean, we've heard sad stories of birds just stuck in a garage, for example. And giving it food and water is not sufficient.
Prisoner.
Yeah, yeah. So we really want to encourage people that have a parrot or want to own a parrot to really understand what they're in for.
Now, what are some of the stories people have shared with you, the reason that they want a bird? Was it like a childhood memory, or they saw a movie or read a book when they were kids? Or
some people don't even know they want a bird until they come into the store. And they'll say, oh, I've never had a bird. I just thought I'd look. And the funniest times is when birds will pick people.
Like dogs?
Yes. They'll decide, I like you. In fact, I'm coming home with you. And the poor person who doesn't even know anything about birds suddenly has a bird on them. They say, what's going on? They say, well, you have a pet bird now. Which is very cute.
Now, the variety of parrots astounded me. I knew there would be more than one, of course, as in most animal. But how many are there around the world, globe, approximately?
Oh, God, I don't know. Lots.
I thought you'd
lots,
have that on.
Lots. So many.
Because a few hundred.
Yeah.
Different
yeah.
species. And I noticed behind your counter in your facility here that you have a flat map of the world, and you have magnets at different places in the world where the different birds originate,
mm-hmm.
which is a great visual. That must be great, especially for kids who maybe they're learning in addition to the adults who never got the clue to begin with.
Well, we use that as a learning tool for the kids to come in and say, okay, you know, show us, you know, where this bird comes from, or or we get a lot of questions, people asking us, well, where are these guys from? And it's just easier to have all the pictures of the birds on the maps so they get a better visual. But yeah, it's amazing. You get people that come in and they think that birds are from some, you know, different parts of the world that you know, where they don't even exist. You know?
Yeah. Wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah.
Like a Neil Gaiman story.
Yeah. But no, that map is a great tool for, you know, for people, educating people and kids. And a lot of times when they, you know, they pick the right place, you know, we'll give them a little toy or something to kind of, you know, reward them.
Nice.
Yeah.
So tell me the type of birds that you breed specifically. Do you have preferences?
My favorite bird, I think, out of all of them are the Major Mitchells. And the toucans, I think, are probably my favorite. The we raise just about everything. It, you know, it's some of the more noisier birds we keep at, you know, at other facilities, you know, just because they need to be a little bit more out in the country than where we're located. But just about every bird that we have inside the store, we raise personally ourselves. And we do that because it allows us to have more quality control over the types of birds that, you know, that we're putting out there. But as far as favorites, I think the Major Mitchell cockatoo is probably my most favorite. Not the best quality as far as pet quality, but it's definitely beautiful.
Visually, it's
beautiful.
Now, do you have specific requests, and so you know what birds to have in stock, for lack of a better word?
Well, African greys tend to be the number one bird that most people want, so we do breed a lot of them. You know, and that's followed by rose-breasted cockatoos, which are, you know, both of those species are great for people that don't want a lot of noise, or they might live in an apartment. And so I'd say those are our two number one selling birds that you know, that we get a lot of requests for. But we get requests for all across the board, for, you know, hyacinth macaws, some of the, you know, the high-end stuff, black palm cockatoos, all the way down to, you know, parakeets. So I can't say that it's just one particular type. Well, I should say, I take that back. Gray is really the number one, but I mean, we get requests from everything you can think of.
Now, when you match homes for your birds, do you do follow-up visits to ensure that they're taking care of the birds as they should?
We typically are in contact with a lot of the people that buy the birds. They'll bring them back, you know, on a regular basis for a wing and nail trimming. If there's a bird that, you know, that we have a little concern about, we will call them and, you know, make it a point to make sure that, you know, the bird is okay. We want those birds coming back into the store on a regular basis so that we can get a feel that they're being taken care of okay. And if somebody doesn't want their bird, you know, let's say they buy the bird and a week or two later it's not working out, I'd rather them come back and bring it back so it doesn't get into an abusive situation. Again, you know, they don't get to choose the situation. You know, we're kind of more in control. So I think being responsible about that is important.
Now, you raise them in an aviary, I'm assuming?
Very large flights that we raise our birds in, yes.
So what kind of acreage are we talking about?
A lot. Yes, we have quite a large facility, and we do have several people that work there on a full-time basis that help them take care of the birds and make sure their base fed and watered right, and, you know, got a good mixture of, you know, you know, fruits and veggies on a regular basis. So the birds' well-being is our number one priority, you know, followed by, you know, it doesn't matter how many we sell if we aren't taking good care of our birds. We're not doing right by them.
And it's lovely that you live near all these agricultural fields. You really have truly fresh produce.
We do.
Yep, we do. And one thing that we've tried to do, because when Stephen and I discussed opening a store like this, there are factions of people that are against breeders. And back in the day, I could sort of understand, because of what I saw firsthand was some pretty horrific mistreatment of parrots. And it was heart-wrenching. What is now occurring, however, is that the parrots' habitats in the wild are being truly decimated. I mean, really and truly decimated. I don't think people have any idea how awful it is. There are entire places now in Indonesia where there are no parrots. They're gone.
Really?
They're gone. There's places now encroaching in areas of South America, the same thing. Africa, of course, the poaching and smuggling of African greys out of the Congo is off the charts. So now the tide is turning. It's like, who's going to save these species? The breeders. the very people that were initially somewhat vilified for doing this now are people are turning to breeders, especially a breeder like Stephen, who has an incredible knowledge and wealth of experience in breeding birds. Someone like Stephen might be those birds' only chance at survival. There's a bird called a Spix macaw that I think there's, what, 20 left in the whole world?
Yeah, not very many. I mean, there's more hyacinth macaws in the United States than there are in Brazil.
Yep.
And, that's bizarre.
And that's, it's again, as Dana mentioned earlier, certain islands in Indonesia where the citron cockatoos don't even exist. While, you know, we don't believe in, you know, the puppy mill version of bird breeding either, you know, we're totally against that. But breeders do have a responsibility to ensure the survival of the species. And if we don't do something to make sure that they're around, they're going to be gone forever.
And certain species of birds, like hyacinths and black palms, for example, are very labor-intensive. You have to be very skilled at breeding them. And this breeders that can do that truly could be a bird's last chance of survival as a species on the planet. And I have personally been to all the countries where these birds are indigenous to, because a lot of people say, oh, they don't believe me that it's that serious. And I'm telling you, yes, it really, really is. And that's not just limited to parrots. That's limited to wildlife across the board.
Now, who did you meet with when you visited those countries?
I went to Africa. I went to 3 different countries in Africa. I went to Indonesia.
But who did you meet with when you were over there?
I hired a private guide. And what you do is you go over there, especially in Kenya, and in Kenya and South Africa, you hire a guide and a driver and then somebody who rides shotgun, because you're in a car with no cover. And different people go to Africa to look at different types of animals. I wanted to see the birds. I wanted to see the wildlife. I'm also really into elephants. This is totally up to subject, but I belong to the David Sheldrick Elephant Foundation. But it's all part and parcel of the same thing, which is we have a duty to protect our wildlife, and we're coming up really short. And how can we, that we're just 2 people here, Stephen and me, what difference can we make? You know, people are always going to want to have a pet. It's natural in people to want a companion, an animal. So how can we best make that a good situation for everybody without treading on too many toes, you know what I mean?
And there's some birds that, you know, that we raise that we don't sell. You know, we keep them, we hold them back, so that we can ensure that there's going to be enough of them, you know, around in the country. So there's, you know, just because we raise them doesn't mean that we're offering them. You know, we have to, because if we don't, they're going to be gone.
Now, what do you do with the birds that cannot be rehomed so they don't become a Monty Python skit?
If we see that the bird wants to nest, and let's say, you know, some birds just want to reproduce, then we'll allow them the opportunity to you know, choose a mate and be able to do that. We also have a sanctuary in Florida that's in a beautiful tropical setting on a nice big chunk of land where we have lots of really, really big flights. And we send a lot of birds there to live out the rest of their life, and you know, in tropical weather, you know, in big, beautiful aviaries.
It's a private sanctuary funded by somebody who's one of the foremost experts of parrots in the world, and he's just like us. Remember I told you about the birdie virus? Yeah, I think he might have originated it.
Yeah.
And he, like I said, and Stephen knows this, we don't just talk the talk; we walk the walk. So we have our own sanctuary for birds that cannot be pets anymore, and we make sure they're taken care of. That's the minimum responsibility we should have if we're going to sell parrots.
We send quite a few birds out there that, you know, and some of these birds are, you know, mutilated, some are blind, you know, some have no feathers whatsoever. Some of the birds that we've sent out there that have totally plucked themselves look, you know, totally beautiful now. I mean, just, you know, they're now that they're in an outdoor setting and they're happy with other birds and they're playing and they're eating lots of good foods, so, you know, they look wonderful. If they choose to breed, they can. If they don't, they don't have to. They're there to live out the rest of their life. That's their retirement.
I was going to say, it's not just people who go to Florida.
Right.
It's the law for everyone.
It is everybody.
Yeah, we all should end up in Miami.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. If I want to end up in Florida, that's kind of scary. But So I'm wondering, because animals are often brought to assisted care facilities, I'm wondering if there's certain birds that you can do that as well, or those with physical challenges who may not.
Well, I am an emergency physician assistant. So during the years that I've been working in ERs, which is about 20 years, I actually started my own therapy program where I got permission from the hospital administrators to bring birds into the ER.
Wow, nice.
Therapy birds, yes. And it was quite amazing, quite amazing. And I also brought the birds to what they call a SNF, or the skilled nursing facilities, where people with chronic long-term debilitating illnesses or dementia. I had one patient who was quadriplegic and couldn't leave the grounds, and who taught himself to use his mouth to paint my parrots that I would bring to the hospital.
Nice.
And birds are amazingly empathetic creatures. In fact, I'm right now working at an urgent care clinic in Manteca, and I had to do a procedure on a pediatric patient, and I happened to have one of my birds. I brought the bird in the room, and she was just distracted enough by the bird that I was able to do what I had to do. And it was great for me, because I don't like little kids crying and screaming when I'm stitching them and stuff like that. But it was just phenomenal. And I would have people come back wanting to know where Pinky was. That was one of the birds that I had. And it was amazing. Birds can be therapeutic just like dogs and cats.
Well, it's funny. The first time I saw, it was animated, was the Tres Amigos from that cartoon. I never even saw a photo or a picture of one before. That was my first introduction. Well, first, if it's an introduction, it has to be first. But they were just so friendly, they sang.
Yeah.
So I never had an aversion to birds, but again, I never knew anybody. None of my friends ever had birds when I was growing up, which is really interesting, especially because we were discussing earlier how popular they are. So maybe it's just certain neighborhoods, and it just, I don't know, it's just interesting to me. Now, for those that are contemplating purchasing a bird, either rehome or one that you've bred, what are your top five questions that you would like them to ask if they don't live here in Sacramento area, if they're somewhere else in the world? What are the top five questions they should ask?
Number one, I ask them if they live in a house or an apartment, because that right there will determine what kind of parrot they're going to get. Number two, do they have children? Number three, I always want to know that they have the correct vet, because avian vets are hard to come by, let me tell you. And it's a little bit of an exotic animal. And also, I don't know if this is a question, but I like to observe how they handle a parrot. Because you can tell people that are not comfortable with handling parrots.
Do they just kind of freeze up?
Yeah, they freeze up, or they're very tentative in how they approach a bird. And
afraid they're going to get pecked or something?
Yeah. And
that's natural, I guess, if you aren't used to it.
If you have a pet bird, your bird will bite you. That's a given. It just when.
Just like your children may bite you once in a while.
Absolutely. And they don't do it for no reason. It's because they've been trying to tell you they weren't happy and you didn't pick up on it. But they don't just randomly bite. They're doing that to tell you something. So that's why we try and help people decipher birdie body language. It just makes everybody happier. And what questions do you think of when people come in?
You know, the cage size is very, very important, and placement of the cage inside the house, and making sure that, you know, it's getting a lot of light and it's well ventilated, I think is really important too. And then making sure that, you know, you really understand what you're getting yourself into as far as the type of bird that you're choosing. But I think those are pretty much the most important parts of parrot ownership is making sure, again, that you're fully educated as far as what you're getting in. And not everything that you read on the internet is true, too.
Well, that's why I'm asking you.
Yeah. I mean,
already, things I thought I knew were incorrect.
Yeah,
I failed big time.
Well, it's an evolving thing. I mean, just since Stephen and I have been doing this, I've learned a lot. And, you know, I felt that I had a pretty good background. I still learn stuff every day. The avian science and avian husbandry, it's still really in its infancy. People, we're right now in communication with vets at UC Davis that are trying to find a cure for a particularly virulent type of parrot-based disease. And again, working with them, trying to find cures for a type of animal that's never really been on the radar. Like you said, it's not like a dog and a cat. We're fortunate that here again we're able to maybe make some strides in how to better care for our feathered friends.
Just wanted to share another story about that same parrot that my ex-in-laws had, because their daughter moved and couldn't take it with her, so now they have this. And they would cover it at night so the parrot would be quiet. But in the morning, you'll hear this, "Good morning." Mm-hmm. Wouldn't get a response. "Good morning."
Yeah.
"Good morning." I'm like, okay. I have to see if this is true or not. It's my last chance.
Okay.
That teaching a bird to talk, is it true that it learns better from females versus males?
I think the high pitchness of your voice is...
Well, that's
really
what I was thinking.
I think, you know, even if you're going to say it in a high pitched voice,
like a child, better. It probably would,
because
pick
it's
up.
Their vocal cords tend to really match that that tone better than a lower pitch voice.
So it isn't that there's an intimidation factor by the male voice, it's just the tone and pitch.
That's the tone and pitch.
Heavy sigh.
Yeah.
Well, what would you like to see from this point forward for bird ownership across the board? Is there what's a good reference place? Is there a particular, as you were saying earlier, there's a lot of misinformation on the internet. Are there any good resources that people could educate themselves on that are correct? You mentioned earlier, aviation.
Oh, well, I mean, there's some really good organizations to be a part of. The American Federation of Aviculture is a really great organization to be a part of. And, you know, they have a lot of pet people that are involved in there. And they're dealing with species conservation as well as, very basic, normal pet people owners. Well, and there's another organization out of Southern California called the American Society of Aviculture, also another great organization, that's here in the state. And keep in mind, these organizations have members all over the world. They're not just here, but they put out periodicals and magazines on a regular basis with all kinds of pet information in there, and you can go on their websites and find a lot of good information as well. But those are probably the two of top of my list. I don't know, Dana might have some other.
Well, really, I would like to offer ourselves, because a lot of people truly want to do right by their bird, but they don't have a clue who to contact.
So if someone is listening to this from a different part of the world, could they contact you?
Absolutely.
I was thinking Skype would be great, because then they could show you.
Or they can email us.
But I was thinking if they showed you the bird, not just a species, because maybe they're worried.
We've already had that situation.
We just had that situation.
Oh, really?
I was contacted by somebody who owns an African grey is it called the Maldives?
Maldives, yeah.
Maldives, who actually sent us a request asking our help in identifying what appeared to be wrong with his bird. And we were able to help him and get the bird help. So I think that sometimes you just need to be able to pick up a phone, email somebody, and just contact them directly. Organizations like Stephen was talking about, the American Federation, and they're big organizations. We're accessible. I mean, you can call us any day at the store and say, why is my bird doing this? Or my neighbor's bird doesn't look well. You know, we're here to answer any questions at any time.
Personally, it would drive me nuts having to listen to this every day. All day, because I couldn't focus. I'd be so distracted. How do you do it?
Listen to what?
Well, I understand at some point you tune it all out.
Well,
all the screeching.
Yeah.
The bird noises?
Yeah.
Really?
Seriously. I walked in and I thought, okay, it's hard for me just to get 5-10 minutes, because there's always dogs barking in the neighborhood. I'm trying to write or trying to get a project done.
But see, again, it goes back to being educated as far as what's best for your living situation. You know, certain birds, if you don't want a lot of noise, there's a lot of birds out there that you can have that aren't going to make noise. And
well,
I mean,
I was talking purely from a career perspective.
Oh, career, yeah.
You know, to
you
listen to
it.
Yeah.
Dana has a much higher tolerance for noise than I do. I mean, there are some birds that scream and I want to, lock them up in a closet from the noise. I think everybody's threshold is different. I tend to like the more quieter ones.
Well, my phone has that little tweet, singing bird.
Yeah.
But I've heard in restaurants and other public venues that people have different type of bird sounds as their ringtones, and it's really cool.
Yeah, yeah.
You're enjoying a latte, and all of a sudden you hear this Amazon bird echo, you know, throughout the structure. It's lovely.
Yeah. I love bird sounds. I really do. I don't know what to say. They don't bother me at all. They're to me, they're
family.
They're music to my soul.
That's why you're the person to go to.
As they indicated, you're invited to call or email them with any questions you may have regarding your pet bird. Visit parrotplanet.com. In my continuing highlighting of national parks, I'm heading over to Mammoth Caves National Park in South Central Kentucky, the longest known cave system in the world, hence the name Mammoth. To date, explorers have mapped and surveyed more than 390 miles of cave passage, and they're still observing new passages. Established in 1941, it not only preserves the cave system, which includes Mammoth Cave, but also the scenic river valleys of the Green and Nolan Rivers, and a section of South Central Kentucky's hill country. The park contains several species of endangered plants and animals, including Eggert's sunflower, the eyeless cave shrimp, and several species of river mussels. After the failed attempt to offer tuberculosis cures with cave air in the 1800s, cave tours, the stay at the Mammoth Cave Hotel, later burned to the ground, grew in popularity. The hotel outfitted travelers for a journey underground. The guide manual of 1860 explains that, quote, "The proper costume for a gentleman consists of a jacket, heavy boots, a cloth cap, and woolen pants. The bloomer or Turkish dress is the proper costume for a lady. It may be plain or fancifully trimmed to suit the wearer. When trimmed in lively colors, which is always advisable, the effect is beautiful, particularly if the party be large. Flannel or cloth is the proper material. It must be borne in mind that the temperature in the cave is 59 degrees. Every lady carries a lamp, and in no case, except that of illness, should she take a gentleman's arm. It is fatiguing to both parties and exceedingly awkward in appearance." End quote. The lamp referenced was a grease oil lamp of a style imported from the East Coast, fueled with whale oil. Whale oil was in short supply, however, so they used oils from cooking. They were supplemented by Bengal lights, magnesium flares, bonfires, and torches. Wads of fuel-soaked rag ignited and slung off the end of a short rod. Visitors had two route options from which to choose. The short route, 6 hours, would have investigated Audubon Avenue to Olive's Bower, then continued along Main Cave to branch off into Gothic Avenue, and thence down to Grant's Avenue to see the Devil's Cooing Tub and Napoleon's Dome before returning and on along Main Cave to the Star Chamber, Wright's Rotunda, Cataracts, Fairy Grotto, the Temple, and Ultima Thule. The long route, 14 hours, encompassed Main Cave to the Giant's Coffin, then behind the rock and down to Wooden Bowl Room, Black Snake Alley, Side Saddle Pit, Washington's Pit, and Gorin's Dome, and Bottomless Pit. Crossing the Bottomless Pit, the tour would carry on into Pensico Avenue, then retrace to Fat Man's Misery, the Relief Hall, River Hall, and down to the Underground Rivers. Passing by River Styx, Lake Leth, and Purgatory, the party would at last cross the Echo River by boat to disembark at Cascade Hall, then up Silman's Avenue to the Pass of El Gore and on to Washington Hall, the Snowball Room, Cleveland's Cabinet, Alindo Avenue, Call's Rotunda, Franklin Avenue, and Croghan Hall to the Maelstrom, before returning by the same route to reach the entrance. The hotel provided a meal on both routes, fried chicken, green beans, and biscuits, among other things, all carried by the lunch carrier, a slave bringing up the rear of the party. The group would pause mid-tour to have a unique subterranean repast, which the slave guides were sometimes invited to join, in spite of their social station. The cave management conducted tours throughout the Civil War, and tours have continued without interruption to the present day. In addition to cave tours, the park also offers canoeing on the Green River, horseback riding, bicycling, hiking, and camping. As you know, I love libraries and bookstores. So many stories and interesting information to explore. If you're a fan of libraries as well, and if you aren't, why not? You'll appreciate this book by Gina Sheridan, I Work at a Public Library, which shares experiences of, well, working in a library. A few examples. Quote, I was in the stacks helping a young girl find a particular series of books. I handed her a book and said, if you like that series, you might like this one. The girl, frowning, said, my friend says that series is for boys. Me, you want to know a secret? They're for everybody. You can read whatever the heck you want. The girl grinned and took the book. End quote. Quote, you know those shows where someone throws a dart at a map and goes to the town they hit and randomly chooses someone from the phone book and finds something remarkable about that person and does a story about them? Well, I had an experience like that. But the remarkable person just wandered into my library looking for donuts. Let me back up. An older man walked up to me at the reference desk, and this was our exchange. I'm looking for the nearest place to get Krispy Kreme donuts. See, I'm 83 years old, and I thought it was time for a Krispy Kreme donut. Good idea, I said, and typed my query into the vast interwebs. Oh, looks like the closest store is 134 miles away. Is that right? I was willing to drive a little ways, but he said, dejected. Sometimes they sell them at grocery stores and gas stations. Let's check. I did another search to no avail. Asked some co-workers, called the corporate number, and found that stores that carried them were even further away. Well, thanks for trying, he said, looking miserable. I hate not giving people the answers they want, so I said, lucky for you, I'm going to Los Angeles this weekend, and they're bound to have some there. Tell you what, call me on Monday morning at 9 and ask me if I have some donuts for you. I couldn't ask you to do that, he said excitedly. But you didn't ask. Plus, you're 83, I said, writing down my name and the library's number for him. After a marvelous trip, a picnic in a sculpture park, a night at the symphony, brunch with friends, shopping, a Sarah Silverman sighting, ooh, I stopped at the Krispy Kreme in Burbank and ordered Bob a dozen glazed and some chocolatey ones for me. Sure enough, on Monday morning, Bob called. I have a dozen little somethings for ya, I said happily. He came straight over. When he arrived, he was very grateful and thankful and pulled out a neat stack of money, not a wad, a stack, and offered to pay. But I'd already thought up a great idea to avoid an awkward money exchange. I won't accept money, but if you would tell me one interesting story about your life over a donut, I said, licking my lips, you'll be off the hook. So we broke all the rules and started eating donuts in the library as he told his story. Bob was the editor for his steel company's magazine in the 1950s, when the Cold War was brewing. The United States government decided to send 11 people to Russia as a sort of cultural exchange, read to spy on them. They sent an athlete, a businessman, and some others, and decided to ask one magazine editor. Bob was nominated. Not only was he an award-winning editor, but also a freelance photographer who'd won all sorts of awards. He went to Russia for 6 months and took 3,000 color shots of everything he could get his sights on, including the Kremlin, sometimes hiding his camera in his jacket and coughing to cover the sound of the shutter. When he got back to the U.S., the government took possession of 250 of the pics. He made a documentary film about his experience, won several civilian awards, and was asked to speak and show his film all over the country. "You're a spy," I said. "Oh, I'm just a dying man who wanted a donut." "Well, now you've got 11. Now get out of here and save the world. Call me if there's anything I can ever do for you, you hear?" And turning to my co-worker, he said, "Isn't she remarkable?" End quote. And she tells about the man who walked into the library asking if anyone wanted a rabbit, which he could no longer care for, was looking for a home for it, and tried the library first because, quote, "library people are good people," end quote. They certainly are. Again, the book is I Work at a Public Library by Gina Sheridan. She also has a blog on Tumblr by the same name, which invites other librarians to share their stories. Do something different. Memorize a Groucho Marx monologue to upgrade that next boring conversation.